Good evening, friends, and welcome back to Advice for Life, Lesson 5, Above Adversity. Just going to open with a short prayer in honor and in merit of all the hostages and all the members of the IDF, that they all come home safe and sound and very soon. I'm going to recite Psalm 121, Shir LaMa'alot, Esa Einai El Haharim Mi'ayin Yavo Ezri Ezri Me'im Adonai, Osei Shemayim Va'aretz, Al Yitein Lamaitraglecha, Al Yonam Shemrecha, Hine Leyonam V'leishon Shemer Yisrael, Adinoi Shemrecha, Adinoi Tzilcha, Ayad Yiminecha, Yimam HaShemesh Le'yakeka V'yarech Balela, Adinoi Yishmarcha Mikara Yishmer Es Nafshecha, Adinoi Yishmer Tzeischa Uveyecha, Me'yata V'yad Olam. Okay, great to see everybody, and welcome back, and welcome to Ezra and Andrea. Thanks for joining us tonight. And tonight, our topic is Above Adversity. How do we show up to challenges? How do we show up to adversity that we may encounter? Now, of course, when someone is actually in a adversarial situation, it's not always easy to come and tell them, what Torah's insight is. They may not be in the space to hear it, or to accept it, or to absorb it at that moment, which reminds me of an insight, by the way. Which reminds me of an insight that I once heard on a prayer that we're all very familiar with. It's called the Shema. In the Shema, we have the Ve'ahavta. You should love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, etc. But why does it say that these words should be upon your heart? V'hayu hadvarim ha'ele asher anochi mitzavcha hayom. What's next? Hello, Tal. Hello, Lou. Welcome. What's the next words? Hadvarim ha'ele asher anochi mitzavcha hayom al Levavecha, which means that these words should be not in your heart, but on your heart. Why should these words be on your heart and not in your heart? Why doesn't the verse say that we should take it into our heart? Why should it be just on? And the answer is that sometimes when we hear something, we're not in the perfect space to be able to take it in and absorb it. So what we shouldn't do is reject it. We shouldn't push it away. Just keep it on your heart for now. And then maybe in a half a year from now, or in a year, or in 5 years, I'll be in a different place, and then I'll be able to take it from on my heart to in my heart. But don't push it away and say this is not relevant. Maybe not right now, but maybe the time will come soon. So when we talk about being in a state of challenge, sometimes it's difficult to be able to start talking about how to see things differently. But we are going to explore, as we have been, the Rebbe's insight on this topic to the many, hundreds and thousands who reached out to him for advice, for insight, for assistance and blessing, and how to emerge, or even if not to emerge, how to show up and how to face a challenging time in their life. Now, just to establish from the get-go that today we're not going to be discussing like extreme type of adversary. We're not talking about Holocaust, whether on a collective scale or sometimes on a personal scale. Extreme tragedies, quite frankly, there is not much to say on it. But that's not really what we're addressing tonight. Tonight we're going to be talking about things that we encounter here and there, anything from an inconvenience to a bigger challenges that you face. As one of our examples, we'll be discussing maybe canceled flight that messed up my plans and I never got to my destination, or an annoying person in your life, or some internal struggle, things like that all of us deal with in one way or another, and we're going to try to uncover some insight in how to deal with them. So we're going to open with the beginning of the story, and then we're going to talk some more about other stuff, and then we're going to come back to the second half of the story. So let's take a look. not listening?
To bring the Sheikh Chabad convention in Detroit, Michigan. Action. Let's say 20 ladies went to figure out how many children did we leave at home. Baruch Hashem, on my note. It was in February 1979. And Monday morning, the women, took off for the airport because they were all planning to travel home.
In Brooklyn, in the shadow of Grand Army Plaza, some parts of Eastern Parkway are plowed out. But as you can see here, other parts of the parkway are not at all plowed. These cars stuck and good.
The neighbors started geholfen. There was a terrible snowstorm. So all the ladies are sitting at the airport in Detroit. No planes.
To give you an idea how bad it is and how long it may take for New York City to dig itself out of all of this snow, that tow truck is attached to this city snowplow.
Miriam Popax, the head of Neshei Chabad out-of-town conventions at the time, now her daughter, Mrs. Feldman, took over. She went to the telephone, and she called New York. They have to get home, and here's the snowstorm, and they all began panicking, and they asked my mother to call up 770 and ask the Rebbe for a bracha that he should be able to travel home.
We're going to keep you in suspense.
They got to plow it out.
Anyone remember that blizzard? Maybe it was only in New York, not in Houston. Now, I don't even know if it was in Detroit. It was, but it impacted the travel capabilities in Detroit.
What year was that?
February 1979, about 5 months before I emerged onto the Detroit scene. So I don't remember it. All right, so that's the story. That's the beginning of the story. Quick question for all of you. What do you think the Rebbe's response was when they called and said that they're stuck? What do we do? Get us home. Our families are waiting for us. Any guesses?
Use the time to spread the good word.
Nice, Colin. What else?
Patience.
Yeah.
Patience.
The families will be fine. You'll get home in good time.
Relax. We'll be okay. No reason to panic. What's that?
Study.
All right. Yeah, good one. Okay. So I'm going to share. We're going to share a story in our book in a minute. But before that, I want to share a different story. Both of these stories are from the Talmud. But one that I'm going to share first is not in the book. You may have heard it. It's a story about Rabbi Akiva, the great sage. You may have heard of him, one of the greatest sages of the Talmud. You know why it's very encouraging to learn from Rabbi Akiva? Because when he was 40 years old, he still didn't know how to read Hebrew. He learned Hebrew at age 40 and became one of the greatest sages of all time. He was a goat. So that gives a lot of hope to all of us, right? We can all, even if we start today, we can make it. Anyway, Rabbi Akiva, the Talmud tells us, was once traveling. He was traveling with a donkey that he was riding on, a rooster as his alarm clock, and a candle, which he used for some light before the phones had lights on the back. So
and the alarms.
So he was traveling and he needed to stop for the night, and he stopped in a field. Now, to his luck, his donkey gets eaten up by a lion. Okay, what does he say? He comments well-known words in Aramaic, Kol ma da avid rachamana letav avid, which means whatever God does is for the best. A wind comes and his candle goes. Again, he says, whatever happens is for the good. And then, finally, his rooster was also either eaten up or died. All three things were gone. Once again, he says, whatever happens is for the good. The next day, he finds out that he was outside of a city. That city was attacked by some brigade, and was only because he had no candle that attracted attention to him, or noise from a rooster, etc., that they didn't notice him, and he was saved. So after the fact, he realized that all these things, that when they happened, they seemed to be terrible or tragic, but actually turned out to be a blessing. Because as a result of him, no attention being drawn to him, his life was spared. That's one story. Another story is actually in our book, and that will take us to text number one. And we will start with Marilyn today. If you're okay with that, please read the story from Talmud Tanit.
The Talmud encourages an attitude of constantly acknowledging that everything that occurs...
Got text one?
One. I already skipped a page.
Okay, no problem.
What?
Page 120.
Okay. Why did they call him Nachum Ish Gamzu?
You got it.
Because no matter what would happen to him, he would respond, Gamzu la Tova. This too is for the good. Once the Jews wished to send the Caesar a gift to gain his favor, they asked themselves, who should we send to present this gift on our behalf? Why don't we send Nachum Ish Gamzu? After all, he regularly experiences miracles and we need one right now. They provided Nachum with a chest filled with jewels and pearls as the gift and sent him on his way. During his journey, he had to spend a night in a certain inn. During the night, the folks living at that inn surreptitiously removed all the valuables from the chest and refilled it with plain soil. The next morning, Nachum realized what had happened. Unfazed, he trustingly declared, Gamzu l'tova, this too is for the good. Nachum arrived at the Caesar's palace and dutifully presented his gift. The royal officers opened the chest and saw that it was filled with soil. The Caesar roared, "The Jews are mocking me," and was about to execute the Jewish emissaries. Unfazed, Nachum Ish Gamzu trustingly declared, "Gamzu l'tova, this too is for the good." Just then, Elijah the prophet appeared before the Caesar in the guise of his trusted minister. He suggested, perhaps this is the special soil from the Jewish patriarch Abraham. When he threw soil in his war against the four kings, it miraculously turned into swords mid-air. When he threw stubble, it turned into arrows. The Romans were then at war with a province that had proven itself indomitable. They took some of the earth, tested it by throwing it toward the enemy lines, and rapidly conquered that province as a result. When the Caesar realized that the gift of soil indeed contained miraculous powers, he ordered his servants to enter his treasury and to fill the chest with precious jewels and pearls. He presented the chest to Nachum Ish Gamzu as a token of appreciation and sent him off with great honor.
Thank you, Marilyn. Do you hear what's happening? So Nachum, on behalf of the Jewish community, wanted to oil the wheels a little bit in the relationship between the Jewish community and the emperor. He thought he was bringing him a gift of jewels. It turns out he brought him a box of dirt. Miraculously was transformed to miraculous dirt that helped him win a war. But do you realize what Nachum Ish Gamzu, by the way, they say he was from a place called Gamzu, but because he always had this on his lips, he's also called it because of that. So Nachum Ish Gamzu, because he always said Gamzu Litova, this too is good. So do you hear what he did? He, according to many opinions, he knew that the contents of this gift box was removed and replaced with dirt, and he still carried along on his way and came to the emperor with that gift. I'm not suggesting that you try that at home, but that's what happened to Nachum. That's what he did. And miraculously, things worked out for the best. And that was his MO in life, that whatever happens, as it happens, he said this too is for the good, and that's exactly what happened. So, to understand, we just shared two stories. A similar theme, but as we will discover, as we make our way through this evening's journey, there's actually going to be a difference in between these two stories. If anyone caught both of them, could you identify any difference in the way Rabbi Akiva versus Nachum went about it? I know we didn't read the first one in the book, but maybe you picked up on something. It's quite subtle, so I won't be surprised if you didn't. Anything? Okay, we'll revisit it soon. You have something?
Well, you know, one of them is sort of, you know, you understand the reasoning after the fact. I guess with this one you do too, but in this case there's a divine intervention.
You're onto something. You're onto something. You wanted to say something?
Just because Nachum had to deal with something at that time, Akiva evaluated it after the fact.
Okay, so Rabbi Akiva said whatever happens is for the good, which means that right now what I'm seeing before me, my donkey is gone, my candle is out, I'm in trouble. But hopefully something good will emerge from this negative event. The way Nachum looked at an event was, not that this is bad, let me see what good could emerge from it. The event itself was good. When he looked at that box of dirt, he said, this is for the good. That means I'm better off with this than with what I had, what I would have had otherwise. But let's advance a little bit, and we'll appreciate it more as we move along. So the question is, why is it the case that everything that happens is for the good, for starters? Why do we have to say that? Why did Nachum say that? Why did Rabbi Akiva say that whatever happens is for the good? Maybe some things are not good. Maybe when you're in trouble and you're lost and you're stranded without anything and you lost your phone and you lost your rooster, maybe it is bad. Maybe when somebody steals this gift of jewels and replaces it with dirt, maybe it's not good. Why are we convinced that everything that happens is good, for starters? Yes?
It's God's work, and God is always good.
God's work, and God is good. Okay. Did you look ahead?
No.
Just because you know your stuff, Sid. Okay. Okay, so take a look in figure 5.1. It's on page 122. And we have two principles, two underlying principles for the perspective of Gamzu Litova. This too is for the good. What are they? Sid basically articulated both of them, but I'll read them here. Number one, everything that happens in the world is a direct result of God's providence. That's first and foremost. Divine providence, everything that happens in the world is the direct result of God's providence. So nothing happens that isn't from God. That is the Jewish belief. Very big idea within Hasidic philosophy. Big idea in the Rebbe's world. And we'll see as we approach the actual stories or case studies that we'll be addressing tonight. Everything that happens in the world is from God. That's idea number one, principle number one. Number two, nothing that comes from God could be bad. Said otherwise, God is good, so everything he does is good. We say in our prayers something, Teva Hatov Lehetiv, or Hu Metiv, Hu Yetiv Lanu, he's good, and whatever comes from God is good. Nothing that comes from God is anything other than good. So these are the two ideas that bring us to this conclusion. Why did Rabbi Akiva, why did Nachum Ish Gamzu say this must be for the good? Because they know nothing happens that's not from God, and they know that nothing could come from God that isn't good. If that's the case, then whatever they encounter, even if on the surface what the eye sees right now, it didn't look good, but still, it is good. Even if I can't perceive the goodness within that event right now, it still is good because it came from God. These are the two big ideas. So nothing happens just randomly in the world. If it happened, it means God willed that. That's how it should be, number one. And number two, that all of God's doings are good, and that's how we end up with this conclusion. And by the way, just... this is not really it's not a philosophy class tonight, so I'm not going to get carried away with this idea. Tonight is advice for life. But just one word on this, and I'm not going to read text number two, but that's the theme of text number two. Whenever, even if God punishes somebody, and punishment is part of our belief system, there's reward and punishment. Otherwise, there's no point to anything. There is some system in God's work, in God's in God's infinite wisdom. And we read in the Torah,
right?
We say in the Shema, in the second section of the Shema, if we follow the word of God, then we'll be blessed with rain and dew, etc. And we don't have to continue what goes after that. So there's a system there. But when you say punishment in God's world, it's not something bad. God is not this angry God that's trying to get back at us because we did something wrong. That's not how it works. Just think of a parent. A parent loves his or her child unconditionally. But sometimes the child does something that calls for a punishment. So let me ask you, is that punishment an expression of anger and of trying to get back at your child? If it is, then perhaps your children should be moved to an orphanage. If somebody is unleashing their personal anger issues at their child, that's a dangerous home. I hope that whenever a child is punished, it's very calculated, and it's actually an expression of love that the parent has for the child. And the love that the parent has for the child calls at this moment for something which would be considered a punishment, but it's absolutely for the good of the child. Even though the child is upset and maybe throwing a tantrum and may see it as not a good thing, but it's absolutely good because that's what the parent is looking for within the child. They're good. Similarly, when God does need to punish, it's actually something good coming from God. Because God, in His infinite wisdom, is aware and understands what we need at that time, even if we may not be able to appreciate it. So that's everyone get the ideas. So that's the premise. Yes.
When God hides His face, is that still? How does that fit in?
When God hides His face.
Yeah. I mean,
so that's what exile. Exile is God hiding His face. Right. We're soon going to celebrate Purim. What's the Megillah called? The Book of Esther. Why is it called Esther? Of course, a character in the story is called Esther. But nothing's by accident. It's because God hid His face. God's name doesn't appear even once in the whole story of the Megillah. Why is that? Because God allowed nature to unfold and did not intervene. There's no miracle in the story of the Megillah. I don't know if you know, and I'm already digressing too much into Purim, but why not? It's a good holiday. So if you read the whole story of Purim, if you read the Gansa Megillah from beginning to end, you know how long it took from the first word to the last word? Quick guess.
1,000 words.
How much time
spans
the beginning to the end?
In the story?
Yeah.
3 years?
10 years. Now, when events unfold over 10 years, there's no sea-splitting moment. This is a very slow process. There was no miraculous moment. At the end of the story, when you look back, you could see that, wow, everything worked out perfectly. But that is God concealing His face. That's what concealment means. Concealment doesn't mean that God is not in control. Concealment means that God is making it look like He is not the one controlling it. But He absolutely is, just from behind the scenes. So, it's safe to suggest that this perspective can be applied to the Detroit snowstorm story. Okay, let's go back to the story, and we're going to see how the Rebbe responded to this. And then we'll discuss it, we'll unpack it a little bit more. Even if punishments are good and for our benefit, this too is for the good. Make the best of a bad situation. Every challenge can be overcome. Okay, let's see.
These are the words of the Rebbe. Monday, Chaf Beis Shvat. The Baal Shem Tov's teaching that every occurrence contains a directive in serving Hashem is a topic that has been spoken of and discussed at length innumerable times. I am sure that you too have given speeches on this topic. Yet now, when an incident has happened to you, you seek to attach the most distorted possible interpretation. That is absolutely amazing. The simple and obvious reason for the delay is this. It is possible to disseminate Torah and mitzvot to a far greater degree than was accomplished during the convention. You are therefore being granted the merit through the snow, which descends from heaven, of completing the above task with an extraordinary abundance and intensity of Judaism, similar to the extraordinary abundance of the snowfall. Your efforts in completing the convention's task of disseminating Torah and mitzvot should be extended to the city, the airport, publicity in the newspapers, etc. Women ran around the airport giving out Shabbos candles. Some women went off to the university campus. Some of them set up different booths in shopping malls, also with Shabbos candles and talking to the women about all the mitzvot of the Jewish women. After they reported to the Rebbe of everything they had done, this is what the Rebbe answered. It is a particularly great merit when the Almighty points with a finger and clearly shows one what to do from on high. May all your activities undertaken as a result of this divine indication be highly successful. It is obvious that each and every woman will soon travel and reach home, for she will have completed her mission.
Okay, there's a big idea being communicated here. First of all, just so we hear, and we're not going to read text 3, but that's basically the text she was reading from, which was the Rebbe's response when they called from the airport. And that was, you're not there by mistake. If you're there, it's because God orchestrated that this should happen, and obviously you didn't complete your mission there yet. So utilize the additional time that you have, as you saw that they did, and then everything was able to work out. But what's the depth of what's going on here? So there's two ways to look at events that happen, and there's some common phrases that we are used to hearing. Something like when life gives you lemons, you make lemonade. Is this what the Rebbe is trying to communicate, or is there something more here? There's something more here, exactly, and that is like this. And this is why I shared the first story before we read the second story. Because in those two stories, in Rabbi Akiva's story, the event itself is not good. But he concluded that something good is going to have to come out of this. Nachum Ish Gamzu said the event itself is good. Now, when life gives you lemons, make lemonade. That is Rabbi Akiva's approach. Life just gave you lemons. I'm dealing with a negative situation. It's not good. But now let me see what I can turn this into. Can I turn it into a positive after the fact? That's the lemon question. The Rebbe's approach is, he didn't say, well, you now have this bad situation that you find yourself in. See how you can turn it around and maybe at least make the best out of it. That's not what he said. He said that what you're looking at something as if it was a curse. You looked at the snow initially as if you got stuck in a cursed snowstorm. He's saying you're looking at it all wrong. The snow that fell from heaven was a blessing. Why was it a blessing? Because it was the snow that specifically is allowing you to complete your mission in Detroit before leaving. If not for the snow falling, you would be leaving there incomplete without your mission done, and you wouldn't have impacted all these people that you did as a result. So the snowstorm is not lemon that you have to turn into lemonades. The snowstorm is a blessing that fell from heaven. Totally reframes how you look at the challenging situation. You're not looking at something bad that you need to turn into something good. You're looking at something good. You just have to know how to look at it. And when you'll put on the right glasses, then you'll see the blessing in what's happening right now, even though if you look at it differently, you can think something else. That is the key component. That's the difference here. Am I making sense?
Yes.
And okay, it's a subtle difference, but it's still very different. There's a new depth that the Rebbe is communicated to the women then in Detroit, and is teaching us that when we look at an event, there's two ways, and the deeper way is that the event itself is good. Not only that I'm going to turn it around and have something good come from it, but the event itself is actually a blessing. How's that? Good. There's you know, when somebody encounters a negative situation, and usually when it's something more extreme, something more tragic, you know, people tend to ask, it's a one-word question.
Why?
Why? Lama in Hebrew. Why? Why did this happen? Why did this happen to me? Etc., etc. And the reframing happens within the same word, as we've done, I think, in this course with a different word. I don't remember which one, though. But today, the word is lama. And we change the vowels of the word lama, and we get a different word. We change it from lama to lima. You speak Hebrew, right? Lama is why. But the Rebbe says that's not the right question to ask when something happens. Because the why question has no answer. So really, it's a question of futility, because you're going to ask the question, and it doesn't mean we won't ask the question. We may still ask the question, but there's no answer to that question. The Jewish question to ask when you're stuck in a situation, or you seem stuck in a situation, is not lama, but lima. For what? Which means, why did God put me in this situation? For what am I in this situation right now? There has to be a reason for it. And if I could identify the reason and answer that question, lima, then I'll be able to find some light in the situation that I'm in right now. Not lama, but lima. And that changes everything. And as we go through the various different stories or episodes that we'll be discussing tonight, if we look at it, the key is to look at them not from a lama perspective, but a lima perspective. It's all going to be not about why, but for what? What's in it? What's the purpose? There has to be a mission here. It was orchestrated by God, then there has to be something in it. And that's on us to figure out. Okay. All good? All right. So, by the way, make sure the ruggles are finished if you didn't have one yet. There's only one left? All right, not everyone at the same time. When I was 10 years old and when I was 12 years old, I had the great merit of traveling from Detroit, not in a snowstorm, but traveling from Detroit to New York to spend Simchat Torah at the Rebbe's synagogue. I was a child. Even when I was 12, I was a child. At least now I can agree that I was. Not sure what I thought then. And it was certainly a highlight of the year, but as I know now, certainly one of the highlights of my life. And Simchat Torah and the Rebbe's synagogue, in very short, I don't know, I'll just say 10,000 people in a room that could fit 1,000, like, capacity. Besides for the very powerful AC that the synagogue room has on Simchat Torah, additional trucks were brought for additional, AC, air conditioning blowing. I know here we can relate to the strong ACs. And even then, there would still be steam emerging from the crowds. Anyway, extremely powerful, extremely joyous, extremely uplifting. Israeli diplomats would always come and join Simchat Torah, Hakafot, with the Rebbe. Many of them have stories. But anyway, always a highlight, a tremendous highlight. And 1977, Simchat Torah, which in the Hebrew calendar was already 5738. Yeah. So that would make us from 1977 to 2024 is how many years? 47 years to the exact date from October 7th of 2023 to Simchat Torah of that year. It was the middle of Hakafot on the eve of Shmini Atzeret, which is the course, in Israel, it's all one day. Here, it's one day Shmini Atzeret, one day Simchat Torah. But Chabad does Hakafot the night of Shmini Atzeret too. Because if they're partying in Israel, then we say, well, we're going to party along with them. They shouldn't do it alone. In the middle of these Hakafot, on the eve of Shmini Atzeret, the Rebbe asked Rabbi Groner, one of his aides, for his chair. Extremely unusual. What happened in the, what they immediately figured out, and eventually they, in retrospect, they knew that the Rebbe was in the middle of suffering a very severe heart attack. They immediately emptied the synagogue so that air can come in, and it was chaos in its own right, but they still did it, and they quickly finished the service, and the Rebbe went to his room upstairs. His room was transformed into a field hospital room, and top doctors and cardiologists were called. We actually heard from Dr. Ira Weiss, I believe it was the first, maybe lesson one. He lives in Chicago. He lived in Chicago then too. Rabbi Krinsky called him the next day. He was a young guy then. But Rabbi Krinsky had either heard about him or read about him. That is a young, promising a cardiologist. And the next morning they reached out to him and he flew to New York and became the Rebbe's cardiologist. In any case, that's in short the event that unfolded. Now, you have to understand that the feeling of that Simchat Torah, in a way, was similar to this past Simchat Torah. What were we all struggling with this year on Simchat Torah? On one hand, it's a joyous day. It's time to dance. On the other, how could you dance and celebrate when our brothers and sisters and all of us are experiencing what we are, and it's unfolding right now? So what do? Do we say bye to the holiday and just not celebrate? Do we celebrate and ignore what's going on? Do we do both simultaneously? Do we dance and cry at the same time? I think that's basically what people did. We did both simultaneously. Similar concept went on in the Rebbe's synagogue in 1977. The Rebbe's suddenly fell into this illness, is not participating in the services and the celebrations and anything. He's upstairs in his room. But the holiday has to go on. So there's like celebration, but deep, deep concern for the Rebbe's well-being at the same time. Simchat Torah morning. So less than 48 hours after this all started, Rabbi Yoel Kahn, who was the chief oral scribe on the team of those who would memorize the Rebbe's talks, in very short, the Rebbe would speak very often on Shabbat, for hours. That's where his primary platform for Torah teaching and addressing anything was the Farbrengen, which would happen on Shabbat. I know Marilyn attended one. Anyone else? Okay, well, God bless you, Marilyn. So when these Farbrengens would end, of course, no recordings on Shabbat. There was a team of scholars who would immediately write down what they just heard the Rebbe speak on Shabbat. And they would memorize it, they would take it all in as the Rebbe said it, and then they would write it all down, and then it would be processed, edited, published. Separate story. Rabbi Yoel Kahn was the head of this team. He worked for the Rebbe on this team starting from 1951, and he just passed away at the age of 91, a year or 2 years ago. Incredible guy, also for a different day. Rabbi Yoel Kahn was called by the Rebbe's secretary, and the secretary said to Rabbi Kahn, I would like you to convey the following message to the people. And the Rebbe asked me to get this message over to the synagogue. What was the message? The day before, the doctor was just about to take blood, to draw blood from the Rebbe. Before he was about to do it, the Rebbe asked him, tell me, what exactly is causing the blood to be able to be drawn? Is it the fact that the needle is it the poke of the needle, or is it the vacuum of the syringe? And he said, well, the poke of the needle makes it possible, but what's actually drawing the blood is the vacuum. And it was this that the Rebbe wanted Rabbi Groner to convey to the people, using this as a metaphor. Because right now, the atmosphere in the synagogue, where the Rebbe wasn't participating, there was a vacuum, there was a void. And how do you celebrate Simchat Torah when this all happened so suddenly? The Rebbe's not here and everyone's concerned. How do you even continue? What was the point he was making? He was saying that just like the vacuum in the syringe is what makes it possible to draw the blood, this vacuum, this void, should somehow be used as an impetus for an even more intense joy, this Simchat Torah, when I'm not there, than if I would be there. That was the message that Rabbi Yoel Kahn conveyed to the congregation. And that turned everything around. Now, obviously, it was very painful for everyone. But what he wanted was that instead of it leading to a decline in the joy, he wanted it to turn around and to use it as a platform for an even greater measure of joy as a result. So this was one way where the Rebbe himself, being in that situation and realizing what's going on, acknowledged the fact that that sometimes the challenging situation that you're in, that itself could be the reason of why something greater could happen. It's the void itself, it's the vacuum that is making the drawing of the blood possible. Similarly, the challenging situation, the fact that I'm not there, should somehow be the reason why this Simchat Torah should be even more joyous than ever before. So in other words, the situation itself, the difficult situation that somebody could find themselves in, sometimes it's that, it's specifically that allows us to uncover deeper dimensions of our personality, of our character, that we may have never encountered or accessed before that. Specifically, the challenging situation allows us to get in touch with a side of ourself that we may have never met before that. Am I making sense? Yes.
So do you think that the Rebbe was also beginning maybe to think ahead on how this flock would continue after his passing, and that he was teaching them what to do after he's gone by increasing the joy and increasing the presence in the world would only make things even better?
It certainly could be applied. Great observation. In reality, nobody knows what's going on in the Rebbe's mind. But this was 1977. Now, we have to realize that it was a massive heart attack.
Right.
They didn't even know how severe it was when it was happening. I'm not going to get into it now. Again, this is books in its own right. But the Rebbe refused to eat outside of a sukkah, even that very evening. He only said they wanted to give him water. He wouldn't even drink water outside of the sukkah. Only going into which was dangerous, you know, to the naked eye, because he was going through this. But nonetheless, he only ate and drank in the sukkah, which was right in front of the building. And basically, my whole generation, even people older than me, I wouldn't have met the Rebbe if the result of this heart attack would have been different. And everything that the Rebbe accomplished from after 1977 till 92, when he had a stroke in February, was all a result of him coming out of this very, very dire situation, which is miraculous. And by the way, the day of his recovery is Rosh Chodesh Kislev, the first day of Kislev, and every year it's celebrated because the world had the Rebbe for 14 more years after that in good health till his stroke. Anyway, point is, it was 14, 16 years before. But if you take a look in text 4b, which I wasn't going to read, but I will, because you asked that, this little teaching here, I'll just read it. The process of extracting olive oil is described in the Torah as crushed for the luminary in Exodus. Specifically in the era of exile, when everyone is broken and crushed, are we able to reach our inner luminary? So we use the olive oil metaphor, the olive metaphor here, that the Jewish people are compared to an olive, because you only get the oil from the olive when you crush it. That's the only way to extract the oil, is when it is crushed. Similarly, the Jewish people, deeper dimensions of the Jewish soul and the Jewish psyche and the Jewish everything emerges when they are squeezed. Unfortunately, that's the reality. I don't need to stand here lecturing about it, because we all saw it just in the last 4 months, how the events of October 7th brought out a new depth from Jewish people, not just in Israel, not just members of the IDF, people in Israel, a unity all over the world. Unfortunately, things that we wouldn't have encountered if not for for these tragic events. So it's the crushing that actually brings it out. The Rebbe gave out, I'm mentioning this because the Rebbe distributed a discourse, lengthy, deep, profound discourse on this theme. He distributed, when I say distributed, I mean literally. He stood for hours handing it to men, women, and children. Exactly 2 weeks before he had a stroke in 1992, for 5-6 hours, a deep discourse, which there's no way to not correlate the theme of that discourse with the fact that 2 weeks later he would fall ill and he would not come out of that health situation. In other words, what you were asking about the absence of the Rebbe within the Chabad world and the Jewish world, how are we going to be dealing with that? Many, many clues are extracted from that discourse on that theme. But that was distributed 2 weeks before he had a stroke. 6 weeks before his stroke, for the first time ever, he spoke unannounced one evening, and he spoke about his father-in-law's health issues and the fact that his father-in-law also had a stroke in the 40s and couldn't speak after his stroke. He never spoke about it in 50 years. He spoke about it a month before his own stroke. He was in good health when he said it. So there were clues in the weeks before. Anyway. Okay, any other quick questions before we venture on? Are we good?
How old was he when he passed away?
92. Yes.
I'm having a lot of trouble with this. So the, you know, I know it's not a philosophy class, but the idea of in this best of all possible worlds, it all turns out for the best. This is the philosophy that's mocked in Candide by Voltaire, and it was exactly, they called it Pangloss-ism after Dr. Pangloss, who was the one who taught it. And Candide is a satire on this, and it was written in the 1700s, where the main character believes that everything turns out for the best and goes through a series of misadventures where one bad thing happens after another, and always saying, oh, something good is going to come out of this, and nothing good comes out of it. So I'm a little surprised to see it here. I also have a little trouble, in my mind, Judaism really is about self-determination, that we're given the ability to make decisions for ourselves, whether they're good or bad, we make the decision. And this is sort of saying God is making the decisions. The decision you have is how you choose to react to it, I guess. And, do you choose to see it as a good thing or do you choose to see it as something horrible?
Yeah, so there's a number of big ideas, and we won't be able to do them justice tonight. In other words, to a large degree, for now, I'm going to ask you to accept these two ideas. Put it on your heart, even if you're not ready to take it into your heart. I'll ask you to do that. I'm happy to stay on afterwards and address it a little bit more. But for now, let's just say this is Jewish belief. Certainly traditional Jewish belief. I know other streams in Judaism address these issues differently. And again, I can't, if I'm going to touch upon it, it's going to take a lot of time. I'm going to say one quick thing, just one. There's a very well-known book by Harold Kushner where he writes, and I'm just going to make one quick point now, where his main idea is that God doesn't have control over everything. And what the tragedy that he lived through, and obviously he was writing from a very deep deep personal pain, but what allowed him to have peace and move forward was the belief that God is not the one that was responsible for the death of his child. And again, no judgment here. He's writing from a place of pain. But in order to make peace with it, he had to turn God into not being omnipotent. He had to conclude that God is not in control over everything. Jewish belief absolutely rejects that. God is in control of 100% of what happens in the world. Certainly the Hasidic belief that it's down to every last detail, every leaf falling off a tree, and the direction, how it lands onto the ground, is all orchestrated by the one above. So if we accept that, which I'm asking you to for right now in order to be able to appreciate the ideas here and the Rebbe's advice, which we'll now see, that's what we have to embrace. But there's more to discuss on it. Did I just open a can of worms? Okay, let's advance. So we spoke about, maybe let's kind of sum it up over here. So we said this too is for the good. Challenges are opportunities to achieve better results. The vacuum of a syringe draws out the blood. By the way, I noticed earlier that that's my father standing right there.
Wow.
Thought I should point it out.
Wow.
So the Rebbe's absence on Simchat Torah would draw forth more intense joy. Hidden power. Adverse experiences unlock access to inner strength we might not have known about before. Through the veil, sometimes we get to see the hidden blessing in challenges and setbacks. The Rebbe was telling those women that they were lucky that in their situation, God actually showed them the blessing in what happened to them. Not always, as Stuart, it's important to point out, we don't always see what the good side of what happens is. And we'll maybe touch on that at the end if we get there. In their case, in their situation, they were lucky to be able to see and appreciate the good blessing that came out of it. Okay, up until now we spoke about what we call situational, those types of challenges, like those women in Detroit. The Rebbe teaches to look for the hidden opportunity in challenging situations. Now we're going to advance, and we're going, one second, to talk about challenges that come from other people. We all live around other people. Some people we need to live with, maybe our loved ones, family members, a spouse, or children, or whatever. And then there's other people that we live around, but sometimes people are a challenge. So how do we deal with other people in our life? That's going to be the question that we will address right now. And for the Rebbe, he saw it through the same lens and took the same perspective that you look at situational challenges and applied it as well to challenges that come from other people, as they call it here, fellow challenges. And these could be problems that we have from certain people around us. Maybe it could be a relative. It could be certain individuals. Maybe someone at work who's undermining you. Maybe it's a certain toxic individual who you just is really, really negative energy, and you can't really, you're really struggling with it. So let's see. We're going to watch now a video of a couple of scenarios where two specifically, and we'll see the advice the Rebbe gave them and how to deal with people that they were having trouble with. I'm just going to give a drop of information before, because the encounters are relatively shorter on video. One is a man by the name of Ron Nachman. He was an Israeli politician. He was actually the founder of a Judean town of Ariel in Israel. He founded the town, and he came to the Rebbe. This was at the Sunday Dollars, as we call them. And he said to the Rebbe that he's really struggling from political opponents who are out to get him, undermining him, and he was trying to figure out, trying to get a blessing or some advice of how to deal with it. That was one. Number two was the former chief rabbi of Israel, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau. Today his son is the chief rabbi. He himself is alive and well, thank God, and is the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. And he, on the video, we'll see how he reports to the Rebbe that he just recently launched the building of a mikveh in Tel Aviv. But within a mikveh, which is a ritual bath, there's different ways to do it. Now, all these things are kind of behind the scenes. You would never know. But there's different nuances, legal, halachic nuances, of different approaches of how to build it. And he said, we just started building one that follows the Chabad approach. But he's trying to tell the Rebbe that it wasn't easy. There was a lot of pushback from maybe other rabbis or other people who were upset that we're taking this approach and not accommodating or doing it according to a different approach. I'm not getting into the specifics right now. So he too was saying that he just was dealing with this, or maybe still is dealing with this pushback. The Rebbe gave him advice too. Let's take a look.
For some reason, I have to press the button myself.
ואחרון חביב, אם נותר לי לבקש בשביל עצמי פעם משהו,
yeah.
יש הרבה אנשים שרודפים אותי, בגלל זה שאני מצליח לעשות את כל הדברים האלה, ועושים לי כל מיני בעיות, בנושא של חקירות ומשטרות, איך אני מביא כסף מאמריקה, ואיך אני עושה את כל הדברים. הייתי מבקש שהרב ייתן לי ברכה, שכל הדברים האלו שעושים נגדי, לא יעלה בידי אף אחד, ושאני אצא מכל הדברים האלה חזק ומקוזר.
להיות בעל הבית על המחתורת של מישהו שקה, זהו יהיה שעת, שהקודם בו חס מנסים חיל חפי, בכל אחד ואחת של מי ישראל. אבל מה שאתה לא חושב רק שלהיפיל מזה כל הזיש, ועד לה בצי יעיל עת יותר, את התשוקה נותן, כי צבר של יהודים, שאין מראים שמישהו מתמגד,
אני רומא מיטרוף, הדגולתי של ארץ שמור, המיקרס, הפשיט את ולחבד את תל אביב, ואני בוא להוגיע בבוא, נהנקי כרדיזיטוף, ולחוב פרקוף, ונחקי כאלה הרבה פעמים מהגישי אמיש, שמתכוון על זה, כל פעמים בעצת הפרוסיות.
אם יש לי סטנדרטים לתחזיקי את השטג, הכל מה שמגוון של אירוס, רצים לתמד לציציר. גולים לתגוון ארלו ולמנות את העיר. אפשר לתגוון העיר, ולמנות בחדישו, איזה מהחמאל של בעצם כלום.
סגוון השטר כאלה.
אבל אם אתכם באתם בבטו גילה, ואני רואה את זה ידוד של מישהו.
Okay, I'll just unpack them a little bit because they were a little quick. So the first one, the politician who was suffering from political opponents, he said, what can the Rebbe tell me about these people who are harassing me and undermining me? The Rebbe said, you can't control other people. What you could do is how you react to the situation. That is where you are in control. And how should you react? Those challenges should stimulate you to double your efforts and do and accomplish and achieve even more for the Jewish people in Israel as a result of these challenges. So he didn't even address his opposition. That's not relevant because that's not what or who you could control. He's told him, that should stimulate you to achieve much more. And then Rabbi Lau, the Rebbe, speaking to a rabbi, he responded using some halachic terminology. So there's a halachic principle that if somebody, let's say, has a contract, and the contract is called into question, and it was taken to court, and it was authenticated. Once it was authenticated, it could never be called into question again after that. In other words, now that you were challenged, and authenticated, because you launched the mikvah, so obviously it went through, now you're actually in a better place than you were before you were challenged. You're in a stronger place, you're in a more, you have more solid footing, and now you're not even susceptible to have those challenges anymore. So actually, you're in a safer place now as a result of the challenges. You've been authenticated, and you should thank God for that. So two scenarios, two ways of looking at it, how to turn the situation around. First of all, I believe this is like a saying, I don't know from where, there's like pain and suffering. Pain happens to you, but suffering is your decision. The question is what we're going to do about it. If I'm going to suffer or not, that I'm going to decide. I can wallow and suffer from the fact that others are undermining me, or I can use this opportunity to say, you know what? I'm going to show them. I'm going to double my efforts and achieve even more. Good? Okay. Another story, which I thought would be on video, but it wasn't in the PowerPoint, so I'm just going to share it with you. In this case, it was Professor Alan Dershowitz. So he... this happened in the 80s at some point, where he got word that at a Chabad event in Washington, D.C., and not like a gala where one individual is honored. This is an event kind of like, I mean, I was at an event like this a year and a half ago, where during a breakfast you'll have, who knows, maybe 10, 15 senators or members of Congress come in and share a few words in honor of Chabad and Chabad's work, etc. One of the people that year who came and spoke was Jesse Helms. And Professor Dershowitz, who thought that Helms was anti-Israel, thought it was inappropriate that Chabad would have him on the stage and honor him in that way at a Jewish event, at an important Jewish event. And he wrote a letter to the Rebbe criticizing, and he says himself, I wrote it with chutzpah, and criticizing the fact that Chabad honored him. And the Rebbe wrote back that when you honor somebody, you have to think about two things. Sometimes you honor because of somebody's achievements in the past, and sometimes you honor them because of what they can be in the future. And a year didn't pass, and Jesse Helms became one of the greatest supporters of Israel in the Senate. And he was also chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, and he became one of Israel's most important supporters as a result. And Dershowitz says he learned a very important lesson from there. And the key is, for all of us, that when you encounter somebody who seems like an enemy, so you can just write them off. That's one option. Another option is, see if you can, if there's another way to go about it. Maybe you can identify something in them that's more positive, and you can cultivate them, and you can turn them around. The easy route is just to say, okay, goodbye, and write them off. It's more difficult, but the better approach is to see if this person is able to be cultivated, and perhaps you can turn them around from foe to friend. And one more on that note, and this is with a senior Chabad rabbi who lives in London, England today. He's in his 80s. He's one of the leaders of the Chabad education system in London, Rabbi Shmuel Liu. And he shares the story how once in London, so the Rebbe had started one of his campaigns, which he did regularly, and there was a prominent rabbi in London who opposed one of the Rebbe's campaigns. And by the way, don't think it was easy. You know, now, decades later, a lot of Jewish leadership and across the spectrum, I mean, Orthodox leaders, who this story is about, was opposed to one of the Rebbe's campaigns. The opposition was from all directions. Now everyone sees, you know, it's the popular thing to do. Everybody is signing on to the Rebbe's programs. Back then, that's just an aside. So there was this one rabbi who opposed a certain program. And Rabbi Liu, the Chabad rabbi, wanted to put together a delegation to go visit him to kind of, you know, take him on this issue. Maybe he was being very vocal or whatever. But before doing it, he wanted permission from the Rebbe. So he sent a message to New York asking if he can go ahead with this plan of his. And the Rebbe said, he nixed the plan. And he said, you know what? If he disagrees with us on one issue, then there are another 612 mitzvahs that you could work with him on. Put that one aside. Find something else that you can agree upon and that you could work with him on. And that should be the approach when we encounter somebody who is, for whatever reason, in some way, not agreeable, then maybe there's another, maybe there's something else that you both can have, find common ground. I mean, nowadays we lost this art of being able to disagree without being disagreeable. And we can have different politics or different anything and still be friends. Unfortunately, that's being lost more and more. And that shouldn't be the case. In fact, the Rebbe, and this is, you know, you can prove it till today, because if you can listen to talks of his, even ones that were not given on Shabbat, that are recorded, and he may be criticizing somebody or a certain policy or a certain somebody that did or said a certain thing, and unfortunately that happened. And sometimes you got to speak out when something is so blatant and that it needs to be addressed. But not once, Not once in his 42 years of leadership did he ever mention a name when criticizing, even if people in the room who follow the news or whatever knew who he's talking about. Not once did he ever mention a name when criticizing somebody or a policy or something they said or something that someone did. Either you knew or you didn't know. But he never mentioned the name of the person in the process of disagreeing or voicing his opinion about something. Which means that it's not about the person. It's about the idea. And if it's about the idea, we can disagree about that, but it doesn't mean that we have to become opponents or enemies on everything.
It's probably the embarrassment factor too, which is a prime principle in Judaism, that you should never embarrass a person.
Correct.
You might have to work very hard to turn things around, not to embarrass them, but you just do it.
First of all, in that phrase, which I think you're quoting, it says to embarrass them in front of them,
right,
in their presence. So this is, of course, talking about not even in their presence. This guy may be in Israel, the Rebbe is speaking in New York. But you're absolutely right. He didn't just do the letter of the law, he went to the extreme.
Spirit.
And including the spirit of the law, and never mentioned the name, even when it would be okay to do so by law. All right, with a little bit of time left, we're going to move on to address one more type of challenge. And those are not challenges that come from without, but challenges that come from our beloved within, our very own. Okay, everyone ready? Any questions or comments before we continue? Okay. So the reason why, you know, sometimes these are more difficult is because when we encounter a situation that's difficult or challenging, so somewhere inside of us, we just think, okay, it will pass. You know, the situation will come to an end. When you encounter a difficult person, so you kind of just tell yourself, I'll wait it out. You know, they can't be that bad for that long, or something's going to evolve and something's going to change. But then the things that we have that are internal, they're not going anywhere. Right? As long as we're here, with God's help, it's going to be the same me. So how do we deal with these types of challenges, which we can't avoid? We can't ignore them. Like you're going to choose to ignore another person, to avoid another person. You can't avoid or ignore yourself. So the Rebbe had a very unique approach of how to view our own personal challenges. Let's take a look at a story that we find in the Talmud that tells us about a great sage and how he dealt with his own evil inclination. Just before we actually read it, I'm just going to identify the terms in Hebrew. So good inclination is typically called the Yetzer Tov in Hebrew. And the evil inclination is called the Yetzer Hara. Tov and Ra, of course, is good and evil. And the other word is inclination. Now, sometimes there's other terms that we use, like godly soul or animal soul. They all mean basically the same thing, generally speaking, for tonight's discussion for sure. And we have that voice inside of us that pulls us to the right things, to good, and we have the inclination to bad. So let's go to text number 6. Stuart? Okay, I guess we didn't have a lot of readings today.
Abia overheard a man suggest to a woman, let's get up early in the morning and travel together. When she agreed, Abiye told himself, I'd better follow them to prevent them from doing something forbidden together. He shadowed them for a distance of 3 parsang, approximately 12 miles. He trudged through a reed-filled marsh while they walked along the road beside him. However, they did not use the isolation in the early hours an opportunity to sin together. As they parted ways, Abiye heard them commenting, the road was quite a run, but the company was certainly fun. Abiye then told himself, if I were that man, I wouldn't have managed to restrain myself from sinning with her. As he stood in thought, slouched against the doorpost and feeling distressed, a certain elder approached him and said, a greater person has a greater inclination to sin.
Thank you. Let's unpack the story. I see some puzzled faces here. So, Abaya was a very great sage, and his name appears on every other page in Talmud. And basically, he got nervous. He thought that somebody would end up in a bad place sinning, so he wanted, maybe as the chief rabbi, he felt the responsibility to look after them, to make sure that they don't fall into anything they shouldn't. But at the end, when he saw that they didn't, and it was just an innocent walk that they took, he said to himself that I'm not sure I would have been able to withstand not sinning if I was the man in that situation. And which is a pretty reflective and serious statement to make about oneself. That means he has a very powerful evil inclination. Another elder or sage who was there and maybe heard him say this, said to him, don't be too hard on yourself. You know, you're judging yourself a little too harshly, that you think that if you would have been in that situation, that means you wouldn't have been able to withstand. You're concluding that you're no good. So he told him, that's not what your conclusion should be. The greater the person is, the greater the evil inclination that comes along with that is. Now we're gonna try to understand that statement. That's the key statement we're gonna address right now. In Hebrew, it's kol hagadol mechaveiro yitzro gadol mimenu, which means that the greater the person is, the greater the evil inclination they have as well. What does that mean? So the basic interpretation is, and I'll say that first, and then we'll get the Rebbe's novel approach to this. And by the way, even the basic one, the Rebbe also teaches in some places, but he still had a more novel one, too, on one occasion. The basic interpretation is that if somebody is a super great person, let's say they're endowed with special spiritual powers, if that's the case, then that person needs to have a proper balance. They need a level playing field. If somebody has strong spiritual powers, a very weak evil inclination, then they don't have a balanced internal system, because it means they're very capable spiritually, and basically they overwhelm their evil inclination with their spirituality, and they'll basically never sin. So they don't have the right balance. There has to be the right balance. We can't be compelled to do what's right because we just naturally want to do what's right. We have to have the same intense draw that we have to the good side. We need to have the same intense draw to the evil side. It can't be that one is stronger than the other, because then, as we mentioned before, we don't have free choice. If our good side is much stronger, then we don't really have free choice, because I'm choosing good because my spiritual side is much more dominant. That's not called free choice. It's only free choice if it's a leveled playing field. Following? Okay. So that's the basic interpretation. And that's what he said to Abaya. Don't be so hard on yourself. You're a super great guy. You're a huge rabbi and a very special guy, and you're a saint. So you have a powerful evil inclination too. It comes along. It comes with the territory. That's number one. Yes.
So theoretically, the Rebbe should have had a very powerful evil inclination. Is there documentation of him dealing with that or discussing it?
Well, you're probably right, because it has to be
in balance.
There has to be balance. So on one hand, from one perspective, yes, you're right. Now, if we would know about it, then that would ruin it. I mean, that would prove that he didn't have control over it. If we would know about scenarios of him where the evil inclination got the better of him, that would mean that he wouldn't be the righteous person that he was.
No, but if he discussed, you know, in this instant I was tempted to do this, but I overcame it this way, that's
not that I know of from his 42 years of teachings. But, and again, I can't go into this now, if you study the Tanya, the Tanya teaches about a character who's called a tzaddik, which means a perfectly righteous individual. When you reach that level, you actually lose your evil inclination. It's gone. But there's very few in a generation like that. It says that King David, after he repented, he actually achieved that level. And there's a few in a generation that do reach that level of perfect self-mastery, and to the degree that they lose their temptations. But it's not ordinary. It's none of us have or will attain that level. But it's very possible that the Rebbe did. Yes, but his repentance. That's why I said when he repented afterwards.
He was very naughty.
Then he reached that level.
I've heard.
Read Psalm 51 if you want to see what his repentance sounded like. Very, very deep and profound. Okay, so where are we heading here? So I gave the first interpretation to that the key that we need to know for interpretation number one is that first the person has powerful spiritual inclination. To balance that out, they get a strong evil inclination. The Rebbe's analysis of this statement of the sages turns it around, and he says, no, you have it all wrong. The evil inclination comes first. First, the person has a strong evil inclination. And because they have this big evil inclination, they earn, as a result of mastering it, they earn a very powerful spiritual side too. The first way was the other way around. You first have the spiritual side, then the evil side. In the Rebbe's approach, he said, look at it the other way around. When someone has a very strong evil inclination, that allows them, that opens the door through self-mastery to achieve a very powerful spiritual side as well. Are you following me? In other words, there's two ways to look at this. There's two ways to look at shortcomings. Either that they came second or that they're there first. And the Rebbe's approach is, the way he wants to view it is that actually they came first. But my shortcomings actually helped me grow as a person and be able to grow because I have these shortcomings and gain mastery over my personal flaws, overcoming them and utilizing them for the good. Let's elaborate a little more, then it's all going to work out. So we're talking about internal challenges right now. It's difficult to fight against our own flaws and shortcomings. The Rebbe shed new light on negative character traits. So Yetzer Hara, we said, the evil inclination that pulls a person away from adhering to Torah dictates. Classic analysis, we said, a greater person has a greater Yetzer Hara. The Rebbe's analysis is a greater Yetzer Hara spurs one to be a greater person. And we'll give a metaphor, even though I'm not a rocket scientist, but I don't think I need to be. But this metaphor takes us to about a rocket. To achieve the thrust that's needed for the rocket to reach where it needs to, it has to carry a huge amount of fuel. So, for example, the rocket that was sent to orbit the moon. What year was that? Was that in 69? Does that make sense? I think so. Yeah. But half a year before that, before the landing. 6 months before the landing, roughly. So it didn't land on the moon, but it did orbit the moon, I believe. The Shabbat after that, the Rebbe spoke about it. And he learned a lesson from it. And he said that the weight of the rocket, 90% of its weight was a result of its fuel. Now, you would think, well, having that much fuel, causing that much weight, is making it difficult for the rocket to take off. So maybe let go of some of it. Okay, very good idea. But if you let go of some of it, it's not going to be able to reach where it needs to reach. So what he learned, the lesson he learned was this, that precisely this baggage, this fuel of the rocket, which seems like annoying baggage, it's only because it has this baggage that the rocket is able to reach where it needs to reach. Similarly, when it comes to the human being, and we identify flaws that we have in ourselves, the way to reframe it is to look at the flaw and be able to say that only because of this flaw am I able to reach a place of self-mastery that I and achievement and accomplishment that I would not have been able to reach if not for this baggage. So I look at it as something annoying. The truth is, only because I have it does it now allow me the opportunity to grow as a result of it and overcome it and become a winner in the area, in that particular thing. I was talking to a colleague in New York a few months ago. Not sure why the conversation got to it, but we are both rabbis and we both do speak publicly, so it's not such an outlandish conversation. But he was saying to me that he's not like a natural public speaker, which I identified with, by the way. But he said like this. He said that I think because he's older than I am. He said, I still get nervous every time I stand up to speak. But he said, because I'm not a natural, I think I give much better speeches than other people who are naturals. Because they think they're just, you know, they could just speak publicly naturally. So they don't put in as much preparation because they don't need the preparation. But the person who is preparing, because he's nervous, ends up giving a much better presentation than the person, than the other one who is a natural. What does that mean? What I may look at as a flaw, I may look at it as the fact that I have this annoying character trait that I get nervous when I have to speak publicly. But the truth is, because I have that baggage, I'm putting in the work, and I'm ending up becoming an even better presenter than the other person who doesn't have it. And I'm sure that can be applied to many, many different areas of anything that any of you may be thinking of or identifying with. It's specifically because we have the baggage that we're able to win in that particular area as a result. So the Rebbe's advice for someone who is dealing with internal challenges is reframe how you look at it. Don't look at it as a curse. Look at it as a blessing. Because I have that, now I can grow from it, specifically because I have it, like the fuel of the rocket. It's specifically the baggage and extra weight that's going to take you to where you need to get. We're going to watch a video of two short stories on this topic of people who struggled with something and were able to turn it around. And if we have time, in a couple minutes, we'll conclude with one more video about injured IDF soldiers, which is very powerful. So let's move along here. Okay. I think I also have to press down here.
I came to Crown Heights to try out Yiddishkeit, to go into yeshiva. I wanted to see if I wanted to be religious. I ended up staying there for 4 years or a little more. In those years, I requested from the Rebbe a tikkun. I wasn't happy with some of the things, the way I behaved in the past. Okay. The Rebbe said, use it as a lever against itself. For example, if you are such an egoist, if you see someone else learning better than you, say to yourself, I can certainly learn better than that. And then go and do it. And when the Yetzer Hara sees what it's being used for, don't step off at me. Okay, that's the end of the Yechidus.
Is a mitava atzeile heiki, is a verstande, a jeda rinyan, was tu sich in dem ebischen Zwerg, was erga de reinu neitzke balabots, is a chazicher izach, as in der Ruf muss sein, behalten tein, und sie mehr nicht wie tolle, an den Menschen, als er soll sich in der Ruf mit Beinen sein. Ist auch viele, wenn der Teib ist behalten, ist er sicher gesagt, als er wird am Eis gefunden.
He was saying to me, you have to realize, that God is good, and everything that you experience in this world during your life, even if your own inner negative character traits or whatever, it's all from God, and it all is nothing more than an opportunity.
When I was studying in Montreal, I was having a great difficulty with my study partner, with my chavrusa. We would be at loggerheads with each other. We would study the Talmud, the Gemara, whatever he would say, I would say differently, whatever I would say, he would say differently. And I went to the rabbi, I thought there was something wrong with me, that I'm just arguing with the guy all the time. And I told the rabbi that I need some guidance as to how to handle this. The rabbi said, it would appear that one of your latent gifts is pilpul, the ability of analyzing and arguing and coming to a certain conclusion, not simply straightforward. The rabbi said that I should spend time in working at pilpul.
Is a sicher Sache, bechol inye ve inye mis dot teiv, un peloshen ha yudur, was er sagt in Yerushalmi, as im do, as im reiki, das rumi kev, eber ke bamekne dem teiv, oder en gefinten nite, das rumi kev, e reiki, rumi kev, e de sibe goze, was er et nid gesucht, rumi dav suchen, oder vimi dav suchen.
You know, you could have taken a situation which, well, to me it was quite destructive and quite negative, and then it was a tremendous power and a tremendous opportunity, a tremendous potential in terms of developing a certain mode of study.
So here we saw two individuals who got advice that they needed to be able to use their what they saw as a weakness and turn it over and transform it into a strength. I would like to conclude with one more video, very powerful. It's a meeting the Rebbe had with injured IDF soldiers who made a trip to New York, and described by some of the people who were in the audience at the time of that talk. The Rebbe, in his talk, suggested to reframe how they view themselves and how the organization views them. And we'll hear those individuals talking about it, and then we'll conclude right after that. Let me see if I can find it. Not that. Let me see. There it is. One second. Why isn't it playing? Anybody? Anybody? Super quick. Anyone has better technological skills?
I think you're on the right track. It might just take a minute to load.
It's working. Yeah.
to be this hope for me.
מלחמת ההתשה, נפצעתי, והשיקום הממשי שלנו היה דרך הספורט. השתתפנו כשחקני כדורעף בנבחרת הנכים של ארגון נכי צה"ל.
ב-1976 התקיימה האולימפיאדה בטורונטו בקנדה, והייתי מהמייסדים והמובילים של הארגון הזה לשיקום נכי המלחמה. וחשבתי שלא יכול להיות דבר יותר מובן מאליו מאשר לטוס לניו יורק ולבקר את הרבי. והתקשרתי למזכירו של הרבי ומיד התקבלתי בתשובה חיובית וחמימות וקבענו את המועד.
אני שגדלתי בקיבוץ חילוני, במתגרת חילונית, שכל הקשר שלי לדת היה רחוק מזרח ממערב, שיוסי לוקרים אמר שצריכים להיפגש עם הרבי מלובביץ', אמרתי בסדר, אוקיי, ניפגש איתו, זה לא... שמעתי עליו.
הם היו שכנו בבית מלון, במנהטן. אז כמובן שאלו שדוברי עברית נשלחו להביא אותם. כמובן הביאו אותם באוטובוסים מיוחדים, אוטובוסים בלי מושבים, כדי שיכולו לקשור כל אחד עם העגלה שלו. לכן בסמסמת הוציאו את כל השולחנות מול הבמה של הרבי, שהרבי יושב. אז בעצם הושיבו שורות, שורות לחיילים הפצועים על כיסא גלגלים.
וכבר כשהתקרבנו, כשירדנו מהאוטובוס, נחשנו בהמולה, בהתרגשות הגדולה מסביב. הגענו לאולם גדול, בית הכנסת הגדול, ומסביב היו אלפי בני ישיבה חרדים בהתרגשות גדולה.
רק אומר, אני אישית בהתרגשות רבה. זה היה איזה רוח מיוחדת, רוח של קדושה. ויצא הרבי ועלה לבמה ודיבר אלינו.
אני אדם בעבור אשכנזי, שהורגמתי בסיקלסים, שכולם יבינו
את זה. היה איתנו מתורגמן שעמד לתרגם ביידיש, ולהפתעתנו הרבי דיבר איתנו בעברית, בעברית, מה שנקרא עברית של ביאליק, במילאל. וראית שעומד מולך איש מאוד מיוחד, מאוד, מאוד אחר, והמסר שלו היה, אתם חזקים, אתם גיבורים, אתם לא נכים.
אין בית שמישהו מהשם שניסים למישהו שהוא נכי, שזה אומר על משהו נכיסס וירידו, כי אם אדרה בצורך להדגיש בזה, שהוא משהו מיוחד ומצויון על ידי בירי הורותום שנוסם לכיחס מיוחדים יסירים על מה שיש לו לאודם מן השורו ולכן דווקא ביכולתי להסגבר על קושיים ומניעס שאין ביחילס להסגבר עליהם באודם מן השורו ולכן אוריסי מציע שישנו השם ויקורו מצויונים בישראל.
ישבנו קסומים שמה, הזנו לדרשה שלו. ואני כאדם שעסקתי כל חיי בתחום הזה, אני יכול לומר שדברי הרבי היו נר לרגליי, ומצאתי אנשים שנפגעו בצורה הכי קשה, עיוורים ומשותקים וכן הלאה. ובמעט שנשאר להם, הם הגיעו להישגים הכי גדולים שאדם יכול לתאר לעצמו, שזה דבר שאדם שלא מכיר את התחום הזה וכן הלאה לא יכול להאמין. וזה הרבי תפס מיד כשהוא ראה אותנו וכשהוא קיבל אותנו.
ובעזרת ההתייחסות של הרבי שקרא לנו מצויני צה"ל, בעקבות זה, עם השנים אני הייתי שותף להקמה של ארגון שנקרא אתגרים, ארגון שמנסה באמצעות ספורט, ספורט אתגרי, לקחת ילדים עיוורים וקטועים ומשותקים וגרועי נפש, מנטלית. היום אני מביא אותם למאות, לאלפי, אפילו לעשרות אלפי החולים שלי, ובצורה זו אני מצליח לרפא אותם.
המאור פנים של הרבי היה מאור פנים. תמיד היה מאור פנים של הרבי, יהיו באור יקרות, אבל בפעם הזאת היה משהו מיוחד ויוצא דופן, שראו שהרבי מגלה אהבה, אהבה מיוחדת.
בברוכו בתדר רבה על הכובד הגודל שנסקבדת על ידי הביקור שלכם, והיא רוצים שרביס באומים תצליחו בהובי שמחו ואיר ויעדות בכל מוקים שתבקרו, הם בחוץ לאורץ ולאחרי זה גם כן בארץ הקדש.
כשהוא סיים את הדרשה, הרבי ירד אלינו. דבר שאמרו לי שזה דבר שהוא לא מקובל. הוא ירד אלינו, לחץ את ידי כולם, ידי כל המשלחת, הוא לחץ את ידי. זה היה מין חיזיון שקשה לתאר אותו. חשנו שהאיש באמת אוהב אותנו. אוהב את הנדרן ומעריך את ה... את האנשים שתרמו מגופם לשלמותה של מדינת ישראל.
ולכל אחד הרבי אמר מילה אחרת, והיו כאלו שביקשו ברכה, והיו כאלו שדיברו עם הרבי. אז אני זוכר שהיה אחד, מרוב התרגשות, רצה לתת לרבי מתנה. מה, היה לו כמה טמבל, זה פעם, פעם חדש, כן? נתן לרבי את זה מתנה. אתה צריך לראות באיזה חיבה הרבי לקח את זה. אי אפשר לתאר באחרי זה כשהרבי חזר למקום שלו וצירף את הכובע הזה לסידור ומחובקים ביחד, ככה יצא מבית מדרש.
So this this really brought home this point in a very powerful way, that the Rebbe first of all suggested that they should not be called Nechei Tzahal, which is the Hebrew term for injured IDF soldiers, but they should be called Mitsuyanei Tzahal, exceptional soldiers. Why is that? Because if they experience what they did, then God Almighty endows them with a much more, with much greater and profound powers to be able to overcome the challenges that they uniquely have and to be able to master things that they never would have if not for the specific, unique challenges that they went through. As they said, some of them became exceptional, outstanding in their particular areas of sports, etc. Just to wrap up, being that it was mentioned before, ultimately, when God puts challenges before a human being, we can't really understand why. However, in the end of days when Mashiach comes, there's a verse that says, Odcha Hashem ki anaftabi. I'm reading from text 10. One day we are going to thank God for everything that we experience, even if we're not able to appreciate it today. But a day will come when the veil will be removed and we'll get the rest of the story and we'll be able to appreciate the profundity, even when something is identified as good from God's perspective, but today we can't relate to its good, we can't identify and appreciate how it's good. The day will come when it will all be revealed, and we too will be able to appreciate its goodness. May that day come immediately, speedily in our days. Thank you for joining for Lesson 5. And God willing, we'll see you next week for the grand finale.
On page 130.